Good morning. Welcome to Turnout Radio, opening up the dance scene on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Hamilton. Glad to be back with you again for another Wednesday. This morning, we're going to be entering into a conversation that tends to be hard for many of us, but one that is necessary as well. The protection and safety of dancers is a conversation that is exploding across the world, and many of us are wanting to get in on the talk and also have our questions answered. This morning, I'm very pleased to be sitting down with members of YPAD, or Youth Protection Advocates in Dance. Joining me today to discuss will be Leslie Scott Zanovich, who is the founder of the organization, as well as Dr. Christina Donaldson, who is a licensed clinical psychologist. Stay tuned and stay locked in right here on Turnout Radio. We're going to take a break and be right back with much more after this.
CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Welcome back to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Hamilton. YPAD, or Youth Protection Advocates in Dance, was originally founded in Los Angeles in 2012 and was fueled by the passion and commitment of doctors, therapists, specialists, and educators for youth in athletic and artistic activities. Now, YPAD was born as a response and solution to various negative trends that commodify and exploit youth and adults in the performing arts. I am so delighted this morning to have two individuals come and speak to us today with regards to the organization and an event that they have coming up this Friday that you don't want to miss. This morning, joining me on the show are two spectacular individuals, including, again, Leslie Scott Zanovich, who joins me now. Leslie, welcome to Turnout Radio. So great to have you on the show. Welcome, Leslie. And also, Dr. Christina Donaldson joins us now. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you. Thank you both. Thanks, Nicole. So happy to be here with you.
Well, I'm so looking forward to having this conversation with the both of you this morning. And for those of us who don't know about YPAD, and what YPAD does, who it serves, Leslie, let's start with you. Talk to us about the origins of the organization and what exactly it does.
The origins of the organization was really, you gave a great description of why it was birthed. I've been a dance educator for almost 31 years. In September, it's going to be 31 years since I started teaching. And I was in Los Angeles in Hollywood as a professional dancer for almost 20 years. And myself experienced a lot of traumas and abuses and things that were normalized and in the community and the greater culture at large that I really felt I wanted to bring education to, because I saw how it was trickling down to youth. I saw how these abuses were not just happening to adults, it was happening to the youth. And as youth continue to become one of the most growing demographics in the professional arts industries, I wanted to create a way that we could educate and advocate them for them. So that turned into the YPAD certification program. And that is now run by Misty Loun, who owns more than just Great Dancing. She is a studio owner herself of Misty's Dance Unlimited. She was our first visionary sponsor, and she also served on the advisory panel of YPAD, why I was executive director. And she now is the leader of it. And it's turned into a global certification where you can do the safety course, which is just one section. And that, you know, addresses things as extensive as evacuations, emergency response to active shooters, sex abuse in dance, best practices, to then the wellness course, which goes on to really address things like eating disorders, social media management, body image, the psychology of injury. And so the safety course is available on its own. And then that's for a certificate of completion. And then for people or studios who want to become YPAD certified educators, YPAD certified studios. They take the safety and wellness course combined, and that requires a background check, which is something that people don't realize is very unusual in dance, because the majority of dance teachers are not background checked. And also it requires CPR and first aid certification.
And so then how did you get involved with the organization, Christina? Where was that beginnings for you?
Oddly enough, it happened in a dance class. So I was taking an adult dance class in Santa Barbara, and a dear friend of mine named Lisa Phelps, who is also an advisory panel, she knew that I was a psychologist in town and knew that I was doing research on music. And at the time, I was doing research wondering why people were drawn to the music that they were drawn to, but also what it meant for them psychologically speaking, and what brought music together and the importance of music. And so Lisa had asked me if I'd be interested in jumping on a phone call with Leslie and talking to her about my music research. And from there, Leslie found out that I'm also a clinician and I work with teens in eating disorders, and I also was a dancer. So it beautifully organically happened where I got to meet Leslie. And as soon as she was telling me her mission statement, I became very excited and wanted to be a part of it.
And just knowing the work that YPAD is doing is quite extraordinary. And the involvement that you both have in it is it's massive. Now, we're going to be talking in a short while about an event that you have coming up entitled YPAD Sex Abuse and Dance, which is going to be occurring on August 21st. We'll be speaking about that in a short while. There is so much for us to cover today. But the few areas and the one in particular we wanted to start off with today and address is hypersexualization objectification. So Leslie, can you share with us what that means and perhaps even explore for those who have never heard the term before?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I dive into that, I do just want to say that, for anyone listening, I come from many years where I was involved in sexualization objectification, and I was interacting in that final stage, which is self-sexualization and self-objectification. So I want to really talk about this with a sensitive tone and language, without any shame or blame to people out there that may be branding themselves in the hypersexualization objectification hue, or to teachers or educators that are taking components of sexualization and imposing them on their, on their youth dancers. Because I think that we live in a society where there is so much sexualization. So what's happened is this has just permeated into the dance world. The dance world did not create this phenomenon. It is happening in the greater culture. And Dr. Tomi Ann Roberts, she is a psychopsychologist, a scientist. She is a specialist in sexualization and objectification. She spent 30 years of her career researching this, and she sits on the YPAD board. She wrote our module for the certification on sexualization and objectification, and she has done some research specifically on dance. And one of the things that's interesting is this happens in covert and overt ways. These are little the micro messages that are coming through us through magazine covers, through selfies, through music lyrics, through costuming, through musical concepts, through movement, how products are being sold, through children's toys. So there are so many elements of society that normalizes the idea that one of the best, most worthy parts about us is what we look like, our sex appeal, our the value put into the body, not the spirit of the person. So in YPAD, we have a term called spirit swag. And I used to teach seminars on spirit swag, which was self-esteem and identity seminars. And spirit swag is the style and fashion of your character and soul. You cannot purchase it. You were born with it. And as you live your life, things can either grow it and nurture it, or they can actually mute it and shut it down. So the spirit swag is the style of who we are. It doesn't matter what our body looks like. It doesn't matter how flat our stomach is, how bootylicious we are, if we have wrinkles, if we have cellulite, if we don't, if we have a million followers, if we have 200. So sexualization is where there becomes a very narrow, almost obsessive focus on the aesthetic and not the internal. And we see this happening when we see very young children dancing in very sexually packaged ways to lyrics that are have been influenced. A lot of people even feel that a lot of the music today has been influenced by porn culture and rape culture. And objectification is when society or a person, a mentor, an agent, anybody looks as a person, as an object, as a part, as something that is does not have feelings, does not have a right to have a say in how they are being used, they are commodified, they are exploited. And this can happen in many different ways. Objectification is not just sexualized. If we are forcing a child or an adult to dance through injury, if we're giving them intimidating messages that if they are injured or if they are sick, that we will easily replace them, this can lead to self-objectifying of ourselves. So when you talk about emotional, physical, and a sexual health and safety of children and adults, these two things, the final kind of nail in the coffin, happens when we start to believe ourselves that the primary focus about who we are and value is our sex appeal and is what we have to offer, even physically, our talent, and not who we are. And one professional said that one of the messages young boys and girls and adults are getting today is that you're either effable or you're invisible. And, you know, unfortunately, that message grows again in covert and overt ways. And the American Psychological Association's task force, who Dr. Tomi and Robert sat on, came to the conclusion that sexualization, objectification leads to mental illness. It causes a lot of trauma. It takes away from self-compassion, and there are consequences to it. So that's one of the reasons why we really, really want to educate on those musical choices, those costume choices, those movement choices, those concept choices. It is not healthy sexuality, and it takes away from self-driven sexuality. And that's what we don't want to do with children or youth, is they develop themselves as sexual beings. We don't want to intercept and impose our idea as adults of what that is. It can be very damaging to their healthy sexual development.
Indeed, indeed. And if there are studios, leaders, teachers who may be concerned that they may be driving that message within the spaces that they are serving children, the spaces that they are serving dancers, how do they access that information from you? Can you share a little bit more about the types of resources that are available via YPAD? And also, how can teachers really just in general just become better educated with regards to ensuring spaces are safe in that respect? Dr. Christina, can you share on that?
I am happy to speak on the second part. One thing I can say is when you're picking musical choices, one of the things that I try to encourage teachers to do is read the lyrics and read them to, imagine you're reading it to an audience that includes the adults. And as you're reading the lyrics and you know that a young child is going to be dancing to these lyrics, do you feel comfortable? Would you let a child read the lyrics to this audience? And if the answer is no, then find a different music choice. The one thing we have so much is we have so much music in the world. We have so much creativity. And so it's really important to understand what story you're having these children dance to. It's not about limiting people's creativity. It's just keeping in mind the person that you're creating for.
So please continue.
I was just going to say, it's really important also when you're looking at costumes. Right. What is it that you're trying to emphasize? Even to the point are if children are having to wear stilettos, are they having to wear fake eyelashes? How much makeup are they putting on? Are you trying to take them out of the age that they're already in and trying to make them look 10 years older? And if so, be curious as to why you're doing that.
Now, this is a very interesting part of the discussion because we'll find that in a lot of cases, this issue tends to come up a lot when individuals are preparing for an example is competition. Yes. And what pieces to place into competition, how students, dancers are dressed, costuming, etc. So resources how teachers can be better educated can definitely be found at YPAD. And I'm also liking the fact, again, that you have this event that's coming up now. Will issues surrounding, or pardon me, conversations surrounding how teachers can also be better educated, will that also be addressed at the event that you have coming up on Friday?
Yeah, actually, we are very blessed and excited that Dr. Tomian Roberts is part of our panel on Friday, and she is going to do a segment on sexualization and objectification, because one of the things that she says, and I think this happens to a lot of us in dance as we live in our echo chamber, is it's really hard to see the color red when you're living in a red room. And the more that we become desensitized to this type of content, and that we have not had any training into the potential mental health and physical consequences of it, we normalize it. So she will be joining us on the webinar coming up this Friday, and she is phenomenal. I mean, 30 years she has been doing research on sexualization and objectification, and she is truly has had a profound impact on understanding how sexualization and objectification has impacted me, because I knew something was wrong, but it was interesting when you put evidence-based research to the consequences and to the actual live experience, it's really profound. And I think then when you know better, you can do better.
Indeed, indeed. And for those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Hamilton. Very pleased to be sitting down with Leslie Scott Zanovich and Dr. Christina Donaldson discussing YPAD Youth Protection Advocates in Dance and the event that they have coming up, which again we'll address in greater detail in a short while. If you have questions that you would like to ask either of today's guests, please don't hesitate to connect with us at Turnout Radio as well, and those questions will be forwarded off to them. Now, let's talk about grooming, because this is something that the three of us had an opportunity to discuss as well prior to today's interview, the grooming and what that looks like. Dr. Christina, can you talk about what grooming is and also just elaborate as well on how a person can potentially even recognize that they may be being groomed as well?
I am more than happy to talk about this. It's a very complicated subject matter because there is so much involved with grooming. The one thing I want to start off with is the way children learn about themselves is through the outside world. So if you think about kids, most of the time, kids, what they really want is to be loved, to be seen, to be appreciated. I mean, we all do, but kids especially, it's really important in their development. So what grooming is developing a trusting emotional connection with a child with the intent to manipulate them to do harm. And that can come across as anybody. Anybody can be grooming anybody. It could be a neighbor, it could be a teacher. It is, a lot of it is building this emotional connection where they're super special. There's a lot of love involved. And that part isn't bad. The part that is horrifying is when they switch it to doing favors for people, either sexually or injuring them and forcing them to work on a broken foot, because I thought you really cared about this team. I thought you really cared about me. You have to push yourself. This is for me. Do it for me. So when you hear any of that language where they're using that relationship to override somebody's personal well-being, then you're in a gray zone and it can get very dangerous really quickly. It's hard to know if you're being groomed. And I think this is why it's important to have these discussions, because sometimes you're able to find out when you talk to somebody and you share your experience, because trust is a really hard thing to develop for some people. And a lot of times with kids, they trust really openly, especially if a celebrity or a choreographer that they really want to work with, or a teacher that they just really want to have that extra special attention, it's going to feel good. So it's really important for parents or aunts or uncles or friends of friends that are involved to just really make sure that your child is being put first, not their ability, not their body, but their well-being. And I think if you can follow that guideline, you're going to offer a much more safe environment than if you were to go at it as wanting somebody to be famous or to be liked or to get the money or follow that. So I think the basis of it is to put the safety of the child first and to ask yourself, is it really okay for my 13-year-old to go off with this 21-year-old in a room that I'm not with? Because it can happen at any age.
So then what are some of the questions then that parents should be asking when they enter into a studio space and their child is getting ready to embark upon, whether it's competitions or their dance career in general? What are some of the questions that parents should be asking when they are starting at a dance company? What are your thoughts on that? If we can start with you, Leslie.
Well, I think that obviously I am a big proponent of studios becoming YPAD certified, because I think that one of the number one ways to prevent these types of infiltrations is to, first of all, know the signs. And if you don't have a team, a faculty, a staff, the front desk worker who understands the signs, especially when the signs can look very much mirroring and reflecting what a good intentioned educator or a good intentioned teacher would have. So I think that going through a certification program or some type of a training on the prevention of abuses of this nature is really critical. Obviously, background checks is only one component. I think that anybody that has access to children should have to go through a background check, because even just for liability reasons, every studio owner should be background checking their front desk staff, who they are hiring, who they are even bringing in as guest instructors. At the very minimum, we should know if this person has something that is a red flag on their record. But that is obviously that's only going to go so far if someone was actually, you know, charged and convicted with a crime. I think that another thing that it is really important for parents to seek out is a studio owner and an educational staff that actually welcomes the presence and the engagement of a parent. A parent is not a burden. A parent is not somebody just to get out of the way so then you can objectify and commodify that child for a trophy or for their amazing flexibility or for, you know, your concept video or what have you. So we need to realize that studios need to be family-centered places that facilitate and nurture transparent relationships with parents. We don't want to shut parents down if they are concerned about the messages in music. We don't want to shut parents down if they're concerned about costume choices. If a parent is, first of all, the number one advocate for a child. If a child, an adolescent, is experiencing, you know, anything, suicidal ideation, body dysmorphia, bullying at school, you want to be able to work in conjunction with that parent to advocate for the health and wellness of that child. So I think that we a red flag would be a studio that doesn't let a parent travel with the children, if that's what they want to be, that doesn't background check, that has the continuing education again, you know, are they CPR and first aid certified? Those are some other indicators on how seriously do they take health, you know, health and wellness and safety. And also, just to piggyback a little bit on what Dr. Christina said, is we want to really understand that grooming is not just of the minor or the adult. It is also grooming of the parents. It is grooming of the anybody that is in the situation that could make choices for that individual. Grooming can also be media. This is why so many celebrities and the power differential is such a huge component of when abuse happens. Because a lot of people, by the time they've walked in the door, let's say as a masterclass instructor, their celebrity has already groomed our brains in a certain way to feel as if their attention, we might remove certain boundaries because they are a celebrity. And I think that that's kind of a cultural problem, that we worship talent, we worship celebrity to the point that we may become blinded to red flags.
And those red flags are so important as well. So creating space for the parents to also be heard during the learning process is key.
Yeah. And with an age appropriate child, parents should be having these conversations. There should be policies put in place at studios where there is not, a teacher should not be private messaging a 13, 14, 15 year old on Instagram. Imagine if your science teacher did that. Imagine how inappropriate if the math teacher was texting your adolescent daughter or your adolescent son. We need to just kind of pull back and look at how the greater educational systems have boundaries and appropriate interaction between teachers and students, and we can learn from those things. So if I'm going to be coordinating private instruction for my young child, I want somebody else at the studio there with that teacher. I also want to be on the text thread with that teacher. I want to be somebody who is going to be present so that those conversations cannot easily get off track. And it also protects the educator. Yes. So for me, when I'm choreographing or I have a job, I do not want to be in communication with a minor without another adult that's their advocate on the thread to make sure that there's no miscommunication about something I may have said. So I think that it protects all parties involved, and it's really, it's best practices.
The private classes is the piece that I wanted to address with you next, because that right there is a huge conversation all on its own. There are so many teachers that see that it is necessary and important when you are doing a private class to be alone with the student so that there's no distraction from parents, other students, et cetera. So what do you say to that? In addition to what you've shared, Leslie, what do you say to that in terms of how do we ensure that parents, teachers, students can all make sure that they are getting what they need out of that session while at the same time ensuring that that student is safe?
Well, I think just take a step back. And first of all, I want to really be clear, sex abuse is not unique to dance. All youth-centered activities run the risk of sex abuse. So this is not something where we want to avoid the activity. Dance is good. Gymnastics is good. Soccer is good. All of these things in their essence is so amazing and important and uplifting and edifying to the healthy development of a child. So one of the differences we do have in dance, though, is that because there's no regulatory body, there are no requirements for training or nuances, in this paradigm happening. So I would say 90% of people that abuse are people we know. So we have to kind of get out this myth that this is some stranger that has just entered our city that is, you know, that in a hoodie with a pitchfork and horns at the end of the block. Like, that is not what an abuser looks like. 90% of abusers are people we know and trust. So I would just say that if this is a reason, and I myself would never say that a parent could not look through the viewing window, I personally do not think that anything would ever trump that feeling of safety with a family. I know that it is also not possible for every studio to get cameras, but that is another way, is that you could have viewing cameras so that a parent could sit in the lobby and still be able to view. And also the instructor knows that they are on camera and they are being recorded. And I think that the feeling that the child would not behave or maybe be as open in front of the parent, that's also age appropriate, because, you know, depending on the age, it's kind of hard sometimes for children to kind of let go of some of their inhibitions if they feel that their parent is watching. So I would also, though, encourage a parent to be really vocal. Hey, just so you know, I'm not hanging out at the studio to be overbearing. I'm just hanging out here because, you know, I want to just make sure everything goes smooth and safe. If you need anything, I'll be in the lobby. So to also communicate those intentions to that child so it doesn't feel like someone's hovering over their artistic experience. But also to educate a child at an age-appropriate age of how to say no, what is consent, what to do in those moments is so important, so that if something does happen and a boundary is crossed, that child is either going to be able to advocate for themselves in that moment, or they are going to feel completely safe to come and tell you, this teacher private messaged me, this teacher touched me in this way that made me feel uncomfortable, so that they know they're not going to be in trouble. So to tell your child that they will never be in trouble, you know, even if they engage in online communication and then it gets inappropriate. We've had several of those situations happen in YPAD. So that relationship between that parent and that child is so important, because we don't ever want a child to think that they would get in trouble if for just seeking out affirmation. So I think that those, and maybe Dr. Christina could piggyback on that a little bit more, but I hope that can give a couple good perspectives.
Dr. Christina, can you share, in addition to that, and also can you elaborate in your clinical experience as well, how dancers can advocate for themselves further to what Leslie has shared?
Well, I think what I see in my clinic is a lot of times dancers are really wanting to be recognized for their ability. They want to be picked to be at the top. They want to win. So there's this competitive nature, which ends up bringing about some discord in their being, which is why they end up seeing a therapist. And I think what happens sometimes with parents is, I believe parents' intentions are really good, that they want to see their kids succeed and they want to support their child. And so they get very excited when people notice their child and they want their child to succeed. So I think at that point, there's this overriding of things that normally we would look at. If we were sitting back and watching a movie, we could say, wait a minute, I'm not so sure that's a good idea. But when you're in it and your heart is in it and you want to see your kids succeed, that's where sometimes it gets gray, because the child really is asking and begging. The parent wants to see the child succeed. So there's this overriding of intuition or overriding of rules that maybe wouldn't happen in the household. Like, for example, if the child is going to go to a competition and is going with their teacher and the parent doesn't go with because the teacher says, no, I don't want any parents there. To me, that's a red flag. Why don't you want parents there? Parents need to be there to support, not only just to keep them safe, but emotionally. I mean, there's such a great bond that can happen with parents in the dance community. I know sometimes it gets a bad rap, because you see moms or dads getting too over invested and they're willing to sacrifice the well-being of their child just to see their child be successful. And so pulling back, and you know, with parents, a lot of times I ask them, what are you willing and not willing to do for your child? And how far are you willing to take this? And I also provide so much education on to parents as to, what is your child dancing to? What are they looking like? You know, is this something that you would let them wear to school? And if they say, no, God, no, then it's like, then why are they on stage? And what is their social media account? What are they looking at? What is being exposed? And I think now it's harder because people are so busy and there's so much on the media. Like, there's YouTube channels, there's, you know, Snapchat, there's TikTok, there's Instagram. I mean, I'm sure there's so many more platforms where dance is being, all this is being normalized, the sexualization, objectification, and what is winning. And I think that's where people get caught, is they get caught on what is winning instead of what is in the best interest of the child.
And I think it's so important that we're talking about the fact that parents do have a voice here.
Absolutely.
Yes, because historically, in my experience and in the experience of many colleagues of mine as well, what has happened is that sometimes parents may hesitate to say when they don't like a costume, mm-hmm. for example, because they might worry that that might impede the progress of their child might not be in that competition or in that dance if they say too much. So expressing here today that parents do have the right to speak up is mm-hmm. also quite important for parents to know that, yeah, their voice matters. It's okay.
It does. Yeah. And if I just, as one last on this, so I, for several years when I was executive director of YPAD, would travel and teach a seminar called Support for Parents in Today's Dance Culture. And, you know, I'm a dance parent, I'm a dance mom. And I would just really say that as dance parents, it's okay to recognize that it is so tempting to live vicariously through our children for our own broken self-esteem. Like, this is nothing to be, this is like human nature 101. You know, you've got maybe some residual trauma, some things that you haven't worked out with your own body issues or your own self-esteem. And then this little person comes along that grows into this amazing, talented, vibrant being. And they're, and it's like the, it's like a reflection of like, I did so good. And it feels, you're so proud. And I would just, I really always told the parents, one of the best ways to have an assurance that you listen to that intuition, that you keep those boundaries, is to become whole yourself. To become whole yourself and to work on whatever you need to work on within your your experience as a child, as a young adult, so that you can then make the best, healthiest choices for your child, and they are not enmeshed with things that you need for self-compassion and self-esteem and self-identity.
Thank you, Leslie, for that share. Such a pleasure to sit down with you both this morning and explore this conversation. We're going to take a break and be right back with more of Turnout Radio right after this to continue the conversation on reporting. Stay locked in right here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Welcome back to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Hamilton, sitting down this morning with members of YPAD, Dr. Christina, Leslie. Let's continue the conversation now regarding reporting, because how we do that and what reporting looks like is something that a lot of us are not aware of. So Dr. Christina, if we can start with you, what does reporting involve?
Well, first of all, reporting can be a multi-layered process. I think what happens typically is when people discover that there's been sexual abuse or that they've been verbally assaulted or emotionally abused and they want to report, first of all, the most important thing is to get support because this is a process and it involves a lot of moving parts. And so it's just really important, again, to put the dancer first, to put the individual first, and to get them support. Support can be a therapist. Support could be a group of people that you feel really trusted, family members. Eventually, what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to call. Leslie, I'm actually going to have you talk about the legalities of it, because I'm not 100% sure, because it varies from state to state. But the important piece I would think to start off with is to get support so you don't have to go about this alone.
Yeah, because we really don't have to. And I think many of us do feel that we do have to go about it alone. And sometimes that's because we aren't aware of what our resources are. So Leslie, can you elaborate, please?
Yeah. And, you know, I think also what Dr. Christina is talking about is that's that trauma-informed care that you and I talked about offline. And we're going to be talking about this through the webinar this Friday, because a part of the reporting process requires trauma-informed approaches around you, which is recognizing re-traumatization. It's really making an allegiance to understanding that every step in the journey of a survivor and the experience of a survivor has the potential to reactivate that trauma. And Katie Gatlin, who is one of our clinicians, she's amazing. She's another advisory panel member, is going to do a whole section on trauma-informed care. What is trauma-informed language? Pathogenic approaches versus salutogenic approaches. So pathogenic is like that, the victim perpetrator, and salutogenic is really looking at the whole person. And that's more survivor centered. So in terms of the reporting themselves, so, you know, as teachers in most countries, in most cities, in most provinces are considered mandated reporters. So one of the things to really understand about mandating reporting is you do not have to have evidence and proof. Do not do the investigation yourself. That is one of the mistakes that people make. You can taint the testimony. You can actually, you can taint witnesses by trying to collect the information yourself to make them unreliable witnesses, witnesses that themselves look as if they have been groomed and infiltrated for prosecution. So leave that up to the specialists. Leave that up to the authorities. You, in order to report, you need to have a suspicion that abuse or sexual abuse, physical abuse, et cetera, is going on. You do not need to have proof. All mandated reporters are required to report under just the suspicion. So that's the first thing. I think that also we can't underestimate how traumatic it can be as a teacher to report. So I would also say, just like the survivor needs that support around them, if they are going to choose to report, whoever has to put a report on one of their minor students, you need support as well too, because it can be very scary. Reporting in itself is actually very simple. You can call your local, you know, child protection services. You can call your local law enforcement to report. I would say one of the most important things that you need to find out before disclosing the report is if you want to remain anonymous. You need to make sure that if that is part of the report, and if that is what you want to do, then you need to make sure that you put that in the ask before you make the report. That if you want to be available to law enforcement or child protective services or whoever that entity is, that is one thing. But if you do not want to make sure that your name is on that report, because it can obviously get really tricky. You know, when you are the teacher at a dance studio that students are coming to, and then they suddenly know that you reported child abuse. So I would just, for in support for you, get really clear on what they intend to do with your identity. The other thing also is, in terms of reporting, it is not a one-off. These are not situations. It's not like you report and it's one and done. For survivors, this involves really understanding the informed consent. I call it the informed consent of reporting, and informed consent of even public disclosure. If you want to go online and publicly disclose, you know, what's happened to you, if you want to, you know, name your abuser, any of those things, to understand that it could come with a tremendous amount of shame. It can come with victim blaming. It can come with reporting. There will be an investigator assigned to your case. There will be an interrogation. There could be multiple interrogations, even though sexual abuse investigators are supposed to have training in trauma-informed care. We can't guarantee that there's going to be sensitivity with every single person that you speak to, so it can be re-traumatizing. Understanding also with reporting that there could be multiple people that you engage with. So then that is why what Dr. Christina said is so crucial, because trauma recovery is an inside job. And as you go through the journey, if you want to report criminally, or another choice is to do a civil prosecution. If the statute of limitations have run out, a lot of survivors, they do both. They do try to do a criminal report. They also try to do a civil prosecution. So there's nuances with both of them. But going into those, having a therapeutic support team to support you through the journey is absolutely crucial, because even understanding that you as a survivor could do, quote unquote, and I really want to be careful with this language, all the right things, because there's truly no right or wrong thing. If you want to report, that is your decision as a survivor. If you feel that is what you and your therapist has decided is the best next step, you do not have to support. People should never feel bullied or pressured into reporting, because it is quite an experience. And at the end, you may not see justice. And that's the other thing that I think is really important in understanding reporting, is that if you're seeking reporting and the justice or the incarceration of the abuser to be the only thing that's going to give you healing, you're looking in all the wrong places, because a lot of times it falls short. So I am an advocate to report as a mandated reporter for minors. I have to report, but that is why going to a trauma recovery therapist and somebody who also specializes in survivors is so important, because they can further walk you through what that experience actually looks like and support you step by step. And again, we're going to be going over this in much more detail with Lisa Phelps, who is an advisory panel member. She's the lawyer that we talked about, who also works in interpersonal violence in the California University system. She developed the sex abuse module for the YPAD certification. And Sammy Rader. Sammy Rader is a social worker that is on our advisory panel. She will also be talking about how to be an ally and how to take disclosures and also reporting. So they will both be on the panel. And Wade Robeson will also be on the panel coming up this Friday to talk about how sexualization, grooming, disclosures, and just his experience also as a survivor.
And for those of you just tuning in, that event in particular, the YPAD Sex Abuse and Dance event, occurs August 21st, 1 to 3:30 p.m. EST. And we're going to also explore a little bit more as well with the both of you, where individuals can find out more about that event that is going to be occurring, pardon me, in just a few short days. I'd like to talk about the recovery, because as you are entering into that piece as well, Leslie, what that looks like and the importance of who is surrounding you during the recovery process. Now, Dr. Christina, can you share in your clinical practice and your experience what that does look like for individuals that are entering into your space? How does recovery even begin?
Recovery is a very different process. It's very individual. So that's not a one size fits all. A lot of times prior to recovery, people are suffering from eating disorders, they're self-harming, they're in a major depression or having major panic attacks. And a lot of them don't even know why they're having that. So a lot of times what I've noticed in my clinical experience is a lot of times the trauma comes out during the therapy. And especially for dancers where they use their body, it comes out a lot of times somatically. So a lot of times they're suffering from major stomach aches. They can't quite figure out their body sometimes will cramp. I mean, it's unbelievable what the body will do when it realizes something's not right. So that's why it's really important to go get some help as soon as those signs come up. What the journey itself looks like, a lot of times there's different forms of therapy that one can do. There's somatization therapy, there's talk therapy, which a lot of times people call psychotherapy. What I tend to recommend for people entering therapy is to really feel comfortable with your therapist. It's really important that you feel that your therapist is somebody that can be there with you and hold your story with unconditional positive regard. And what that really means is that you do not feel judged, so you do not have to worry about taking care of the therapist, and that you can go through the variety of emotions you're going to be feeling. It's really common for survivors to want to protect the person that has been abusing them because of that emotional connection that they have. Again, as Leslie had spoken about earlier, a lot of times these are people that they know and care about, and there's an emotional bond. So what we try to do is get them to experience their feelings, to feel safe in that experience, to feel safe in their skin, and to work through some of the nuances, because a lot of times there's a miscommunication. So they mistake love for abuse. And so we have to rework that and reprogram kind of the brain into recognizing what is healthy and what is not healthy.
And there's no particular time at all that can be defined for each individual, mm-hmm. because everybody is coming with their own separate experience. Mm-hmm. So long-term counseling, long-term therapy might be the case for one individual, whereas someone else could have a shorter term of therapy, for example.
Yeah. For me, I will say that talk therapy didn't, I am a survivor of child sexual abuse, and I'm also a survivor of adult sexual assault. And I'm also a survivor of sexual harassment in the workplace as a professional dancer. I've had a lot of different experiences. And I will say for me, The things like EMDR and the somatic things that really get trauma lives in the body. It's cellular. So, you know, a lot of dancers can experience, like Dr. Tina said, chronic pain, you engaging in eating disorders, self-harming behaviors, but just physiologically to work that trauma out. A lot of the latest research is showing that talk therapy is not enough to actually come through the trauma recovery. And Wade is going to dive a little bit deeper on our webinar about, he has gone through a tremendous amount of trauma recovery. And you can literally, like, you know, I've known Wade for a lot of years, and you can really even just feel in the, his essence, his recovery for people that knew him before and that know him now. And he's, you know, gone through so much, therapeutic modalities. It's quite amazing. People can find recovery. And, I can't give this message of hope enough. The recovery is so profound. People go on to live full, vibrant, purpose-filled lives. And usually these are the best people that become advocates. That I would also say that one of the best ways to be an advocate is to first recover yourself. Because I think a lot of times people who are survivors but have not dealt with that trauma yet, they get into advocacy and before they're quite ready. They need to, you can't walk around your own recovery and then be an advocate. You need to, for, you know, kind of put on your own oxygen mask before you put on someone else's. It's a cliche for a reason, because it's true. Because then that way you won't distract your own recovery or cope with your own triggers or activators by trying to help someone else's recovery, and maybe use it as an obstacle to where you need to go in your own personal growth.
I think also exploring, this is excellent. I think also exploring the fact that for many of us, talk therapy is all that we know of. That can assist and support us to the next level. So what are those many other examples, right? Many of us will think, okay, do I enter into a counseling platform that is very holistic, or perhaps maybe that's not for me? Or do I enter into a platform, for example, that is the total opposite of that? So moving past the idea that there is more than just talk therapy out there, I think is so crucial. Thank you for sharing that, because many of us, that is all we know.
Yeah. And we're going to be talking about that on the webinar also, because it, you know, chronic illness and trauma go hand in hand. And a lot of that is because trauma lives in the body physiologically, cellularly. Epigenetics is something that I've been involved with in studying and understanding trauma. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different options out there for trauma recovery, and a lot of hope for, and I also want to say, it's not just for the survivor. It's for the parents. It's for the siblings. It's for the friends who knew and didn't say anything. It's for the teachers who knew and didn't say anything. It's for anybody that was just ill-equipped. And if anybody watched Athlete A, which was the documentary on Larry Nassar, and we have, as a YPAT ambassador, one of the survivors of Larry Nassar, who actually, through YPAT certification, came to the realization, she wrote a blog on it, that she was sexually abused by Larry Nassar. And it, you know, if you watch that story of the complicity and the complacency, and then it kind of vibrates up to this justice and these survivors telling their story. I mean, for some of them, it was 16 years. There's no timeline. There's no right time to come out with this. We need to really understand that disassociating from trauma, blacking out trauma, denying sex abuse is more, it is literally normal. That is normal. So for people who say, why didn't they report? Why didn't they tell me? Those are questions that we kind of need to remove from the conversation. It's not trauma-informed. It can be re-traumatizing. It can shut down a survivor. And it's not being an ally. You know, it's asking somebody why they waited is not helpful, because for a lot of people, they didn't even realize what happened to them themselves was sex abuse. Or like Dr. Tina said, they loved this person. This person, in a lot of cases that I have taken, and a lot of cases I worked on when I ran the sex abuse division in YPAT, these are people who the survivors feel they owe their whole career to. That their whole career would not have been possible if it wasn't for this one mentor or this one teacher. So there is quite a lot to unpack there. And Tina, Dr. Tina, is going to be the one this Friday who also goes over the warning signs. What are the warning signs? If a vibrant child who is usually so social comes into class and is all of a sudden, you know, disassociated, like what are the warning signs of behavioral changes in children and in adults that we can be aware of as allies? And Dr. Tina is actually going to be teaching that part of the webinar this Friday.
Thank you for that, Leslie. And of course, for individuals who are wishing to register, the YPAD Sex Abuse in Dance event is occurring August 21st, 1 to 3:30 p.m. As you mentioned, that's EST. Now, individuals can follow the organization at YPAD Now on Instagram, and of course, find out more information at ypadnow.com. So we know the registration is free. The event itself is free. Anything else that individuals should know prior to attending the event, Dr. Christina?
I would say that it is going to be a well-educated, there's a lot of education coming out. And if you are a survivor, the first thing I'm going to tell you is take care of yourself. Because a lot of, even though we are trying to be trauma-informed, we're talking about really intense issues. And a lot of times when people talk about it and they hear examples being brought up, it can actually bring up more of their own trauma. And so I just really want to let people know that it is okay to take care of yourself. If you're listening to it and then realize, I'm starting to feel like I'm having a panic attack, or your heart's really, you know, palpitating and you're frequent swallowing and you're getting sweaty, then maybe it's time to take a break. Know that this is going to be recorded. You can come back and listen to it anytime. There's no reason to have to push through any discomfort if you're getting triggered through this. So that is the one thing I really just ask people, is to take care of themselves as they're listening to it.
Thank you. Thank you again. And as we close, I'm going to head to you, Leslie, for any last words that you also wish to share with regards to YPAD or the event coming up.
This event coming up is for everyone, parents, educators, studio owners, competition owners, convention owners, anybody who loves the arts and wants to be a better advocate in the arts. You know, one of the things that is so important and encouraging is that almost 100% of sex abuse is preventable through education and through the community uniting to be educated, to prevent it, and to recognize the red flags. And I think that it is really rare you have something that is so epidemic as sex abuse. You know, in America, 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before they're 18 years of age. I mean, the numbers globally are astronomical. There's very few things that we can actually say can be prevented just by sitting down and getting trained about it. And I just encourage you to, if you care about this, if you maybe you're not sure you care about this, please join us. And as Tina said, if you can't be with us physically, this will be now sitting, the webinar and the sex abuse module directly from YPAD certification will be sitting at ypadnow.com. I would say give us a little time to work out the tech after the seminar, but I would say by this time next week, you are going to have a plethora of free information, and there is no excuse or obstacle of why, if you care about the arts, if you care about dance, for you to just give us 2.5 hours of your time. And I really want to say this advisory panel is so intelligent and compassionate and loving. And I walk away every time, as you are too, Nicole, by the way. I mean, can we just say Nicole's pretty amazing too. I just want to say Nicole reminds me of all of these amazing advisory panel members. So yeah, just please come and join us, and let's handle this. This does not need to be an epidemic. We can stop this. We don't have to have this become, dance should not come with a trauma debt of sex abuse. Mm-hmm. And we can stop this. So let's do it.
Well, you are both wonderful, and thank you for that, Leslie. Thank you to the both of you for beautifully sharing this morning and for opening up the conversation with us here on Turnout Radio. We greatly appreciate you. And of course, as you reminded us, YPAD Now is where individuals can find out more information on Instagram, and also ypadnow.com is where individuals can find out more online. Please don't miss this one. For more information, please connect with us here as well at Turnout Radio. Dr. Christina, Leslie, thank you again for joining me here this morning. Such a pleasure to sit down with both of you.
Thank you so much, Nicole. Yeah, and thank you to Misty Lown and Emily Sweeney, the YPAD manager, because without them, none of this happens. So thank you also.
Thank you. Great pleasure to have you both here again this morning. And folks, please don't miss the event. It's happening this Friday, August 21st, 1 to 3:30 p.m. EST. Don't miss it. That's it for today's show. Thank you for joining us here on Turnout Radio. Make sure that you visit us at turnoutradio.com for more information about the show. And be sure to tune in next week, Wednesday at 9 a.m. EST. Today's music, for those of you who are tuning in and wondering, Train's Slow Blues by John Coltrane was our mid-show song. Thank you again for sitting down with us. We look forward to having you join us again next week. I'm Nicole Hamilton. I hope your week finds you turning out to dance.